Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a minute, our conversation today, the pitfalls of online gambling. But first, is there some sleight of hand going on with accounting standards? There was a key accounting rule change yesterday. Under the new expanded rule, financial companies are allowed to record higher values for troubled assets, like mortgages, than they're really worth. Wait a minute. Isn't that what got us into the current mess in the first place? Binyamin Applebaum is business reporter for The Washington Post. And, Binya, the Financial Accounting Standards Board made this rule change with unusual speed and under a lot of pressure from the finance industry. To explain the new rule, let's start with the existing rule, the fair market value rule.
The rule as it stands now basically says that an asset, the things owned by banks, is worth as much as someone else is willing to pay for it. Just like a house is worth as much as someone else is willing to pay for it. And it requires banks to disclose the value of their assets in their quarterly financial filings and to tell investors, here are our assets, here is how much they are worth, and we know that because other people are willing to pay that price for them.
It's called marking the market, but you write, when there is no market, when people aren't willing to buy things like, oh, really bad securitized mortgages, there is an exception, and yesterday's ruling sort of expanded on that exception. So what does it allow?
Right. So there's always been this rule that says if there are no buyers, if you can't find anyone who's paying for similar things, you clearly need some other way of assigning a value. And you do that by basically looking at how much you initially paid for it, perhaps how much revenue it's bringing in. A mortgage is collecting payments from the borrower, and you can assign a value on that basis. And basically what banks wanted was permission to treat the current market, in which there are buyers, but those buyers are offering very low prices, as if there are not buyers, basically to ignore the existing buyers on the grounds that the market is very distressed right now, that the prices don't reflect the reality of how much assets are worth, that there's fear in the market, confusion, ignorance, and that those things are unfairly driving down the true prices of assets, and therefore that they ought to be able to ignore those prices. And the FASB basically gave them permission yesterday to do that in some cases.
Well, and this becomes very important for a couple of reasons. One, you write, is that banks are required to set aside money when an asset declines in value. And if they can sort of, on their books, raise the value of an asset, they don't have to set aside as much money.
Yeah, there's some very good financial analysts who think that this could bump bank earnings up by as much as 20% instantly. Just because they've changed the rules of the game, banks would be able to report that they made in some cases, up to 20% more money.
But, Binya, isn't this exactly what got us where we are today? It's sort of a, you know, house of mirrors.
It's a real concern. There is a real concern here among many investor groups, among many accounting groups, that this will serve to obscure the true value of these assets, that it will delay the recovery, that it will, yeah, exactly, perpetuate ledger domain that is not good for the financial system.
Well, and the other problem is that right now banks are being pushed to sell off some of these bad assets, and private investors are being asked to buy it. How can anyone know what they're buying if they don't know the real true value of it?
This is the real problem here. The government's goal for fixing the banking system is to convince private investors to start buying assets from banks again. And the fundamental problem in the marketplace right now is that those investors don't agree with the banks about how much the assets are worth. And the concern here is that the FASB has basically sided with the banks and given them validation for the higher prices that they are demanding, and that stands to delay the day on which investors and banks will finally agree. And that is so important because that is the major source of funding for lending in this country, is the ability of banks to sell the last loan they made to investors, to get cash for it, and then to pass that cash through to a new set of borrowers.
Yeah, and to further drive the point home, this is exactly what banks don't allow civilians to do. You know, as a homeowner, you can't go in and say to a bank, my house is actually worth what I paid for it 3 years ago.
Right.
So I'd like to refinance it. That you can't do that. And this is what banks are asking to do. So what argument are lawmakers and the board making for doing this? We read that the head of the board said in the New York Times that he thought this was good for investors. How so?
Well, the board is doing two things here. The thing that they say is good for investors is they are also requiring increased disclosure. They want banks to explain on what basis they arrived at the new value that they have determined the asset is worth, to to explain what their old methodology was, to explain perhaps what the difference is between the outcome of the old and the new methodology. So there's going to be more information for investors, and the FASB is basically presenting that as progress. The argument that the industry makes in favor of this is they believe that, you know, by forcing banks to write down the value of assets to the prices that other investors are willing to pay for those assets, it has basically overstated the problems that banks face, and as a consequence, it has exacerbated their inability to lend. It has basically tied up cash in these set-asides that we talked about earlier that they need to put aside to cover projected losses. It has left less money for lending, and that if you just change these values, you will have more money for lending, a more accurate reflection of the bank's financial condition, and that will improve the economy.
Well, Benjamin, this is a private board that made this decision. It's not through Congress. Going forward, what's your sense that it's going to stay, this new rule?
I think it's quite likely that a form of this will remain. Congress demanded this. This board was under tremendous pressure to act. There are a lot of questions about whether this board has the necessary independence to do its job well, but as presently constituted, this is how it does its job. It has responded to political pressure in the past. It has done it again this time. This is how the process works.
Benjamin Applebaum, business reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, here's another cautionary tale about money. Entertainment reporter Martha Frankel grew up with gambling, listening as her mother clicked the mahjong tiles with her girlfriends and watching the poker games that her dad ran with the men in the next room. Martha didn't take up poker herself until she was in her mid-40s, but even though she began to arrange her entire life around her playing schedule, she said she was still under control until she discovered online poker.
When I have a bankroll of $3,000, I go to a $10, $20 hold'em game. I get beat by players that are staying in with crap. I get beat by players that are laughing at me. The only common thread is that I get beat. The money doesn't last 4 days. I will stop tomorrow, I tell myself, or Monday, first of the month, right after I win back what they owe me.
Martha Frankel shared her story of her addiction to online gambling in her memoir, Hats and Eyeglasses, A Family Love Affair with Gambling, which is now in paperback. We spoke to her when the book was first published and began by asking about that title.
When I was about 4, I was in the house. My mother was playing mahjong with her girlfriends in the kitchen, and my dad was playing poker with their husbands in the living room. And one of the guys said, "I have hats and eyeglasses." And I said, "What does that mean?" And he bent down to show me his hand. He said, "It means I have crapola. It's like when a ship goes down and all that floats to the surface is hats and eyeglasses." And it became code in our family for when you were doing bad, but especially when you were doing bad at gambling.
And, of course, it becomes a metaphor for what happens to you by the end of the book. But, you know, that family where you were the 4-year-old, 6-year-old, you know, sitting in people's laps, watching the game, a loving family, lots of aunts and uncles that weren't really related to you.
Right.
Gambling had a really great feel to it.
It did. And I you know what? Gambling is enticing because it's pretty great. You know, I went to the track with my father. I loved it.
In fact, you got the nickname the Grecian because what happened?
I picked a really long shot at a Belmont Stakes, and they started calling me the Grecian in respect to the odds maker, Jimmy the Greek. Mm. You know, I loved it. I loved all of it. I loved playing cards. My cousins and I bet on everything. That was the way it was in my family. And you needed to put up the money. You know, you put up or shut up.
Right. But you didn't take it up, as we said, until you were older. You married a man, Steve, because he didn't even watch football.
Yeah, I didn't know the difference between football. And I called him during the World Series, and he asked me for a date. And I said, "Aren't you going to watch the game?" He said, "No, I don't like football." And I thought, "Oh, my God, I'm going to marry this guy." He didn't know that a baseball game was on that night.
He didn't know baseball was World Series.
Yeah, he didn't know any of it.
Then you sound like you have a terrific entertainment career going. You're dancing the conga with Chris Walken. You go CD shopping with Jeff Bridges. You know, you've got a really good career going. And start researching a screenplay and go to a Wednesday night guys poker game to learn more about poker. What was that feeling going back into that thing in your 40s that you'd grown up with?
It was as if 40 years had slipped by and the same men were sitting there with the same kind of, you know, I've been around women. I have a lot of women friends. I love being around women. But there's that thing with women of, how are you? What are you thinking? How do you feel? I started playing poker with these guys, and on the way home, I asked my buddy if one of them was married. He said, "I have no idea."
Right.
They never talked. They talked about golf and poker.
Yeah.
And it was really sort of refreshing.
You fit in. At first, you didn't know what you were doing, but boy, you got really good. There's that moment where you stun everyone into silence with your winning hand.
Yeah.
And go on to
poker cruises and playing so much that your hands hurt. Start rearranging your schedule. Start turning down interview assignments so that you can, you know, pursue poker. But you say that you were in control. That doesn't sound like it's in control.
I was obsessed, sure, you know, but it was, it's that way you get about a, you know, a new hobby or a new, I mean, I remember when I first started knitting, I used to dream about yarn. I used to, you know, it was that kind of obsession.
And by the way, what made you good?
Well, everything I'd been doing for the last 20 years, watching people, listening to people, I can look around this room and close my eyes and remember everything where it is. And also, I'd been doing the interviews for a long time, so I understand that a lot of it is subtext. The question you're asking is not really what you want to know. And at the poker table, that's exactly the thing that'll make people relax. And I don't know, I think I was just born to do it.
Plus, you could also tell. You knew when people were cheating.
Yeah.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, I knew
stuff.
The first night I played with my Wednesday night game, there was a guy at the game who was cheating. I knew it within right. 5 minutes.
Right. Well, now you come to online gambling, online poker. You can't look around that room. You can't read someone else's face. What starts to happen when you start playing online poker?
From the beginning, I wasn't good at it. But instead of saying, okay, like I wanted to play hockey, but I couldn't skate, so I wouldn't do it again, I kept going back to this thing and trying to figure out the way in.
So here's where I think by your definition, it crossed from an obsession like knitting to an addiction. How bad did it get?
It got as bad as it could get for me. You know, I was losing a lot of money, and I was, you know, nobody knew.
Lying to your husband?
Never even told him.
You're staying off the phone. You're keeping friends from calling you to keep the internet open.
I kept telling everybody to stop bothering me. I was busy, 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 busy.
Picking fights with your husband so that you could go and cry over your losses.
And I think it was the classic, you know, when they say insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. That's really what it was. And I have felt from the beginning that online gambling is a different animal than live gambling. And now I'm getting a lot of feedback from the book, from gamblers, from people in Gamblers Anonymous. And they say that this, it's like what happened when crack cocaine came out as opposed to cocaine. Not that I'm advocating any of them. But I think online addiction is really going to be a huge, it's just not just me. It's impossible that it would just be me.
Yeah. And you started finding that out because you went to 12-step groups for gamblers.
I did. It didn't work out well for me.
Your first group, yeah, it was you and I think five guys, and you said it felt like a poker game.
Well, it was more than that. I went there and everybody said, you know, I've only been gambling free for like 12 days, 40 days. I've been in Gamblers Anonymous for 7 years. I said, well, what happened? Oh, I went to Atlantic City last week. Well, that was what I wanted to hear. Plus, it was five guys sitting around about talking about the horses, cards, and baseball. That's my life. I love that life. And they seemed like such losers. And, you know, of course, it took me a long time to realize that I was one of them.
That's author Martha Frankl. Okay, how much money does she think she really lost? We'll hear after the break. And coming up later, your thoughts on the week's stories. Hint, many of you don't like the idea of genetically modified foods possibly playing a positive role in farming. As you'll hear later, back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're revisiting our conversation with entertainment reporter Martha Frankl about her memoir, Hats and Eyeglasses. The book tells the story of her addiction to online poker and how she broke that addiction ultimately. But when we spoke to her, we also had to ask about something else she mentions in her memoir. She still plays her Wednesday night old-fashioned poker game.
I do. I know. And a lot of there's a lot of people in Gamblers Anonymous who freak out when they hear that. But the paradigm has to change because at the most, Gamblers Anonymous will tell you that they have a 15% success rate. That means that 85% don't work. So we have to change, the paradigm in how there are heroin addicts who could smoke a joint. There are maybe gamblers who can do some things and not others. I have no idea.
But really, you're saying
For me, that was a terrible addiction that had nothing to do with that social fun thing that I do on Wednesday nights with people I really adore. how I stopped was the way anybody stops any addiction is I was shamed into it. My mother, who was getting old, had called one day crying and just said, you know, what have I done to break your heart that you've, you know, turned your back on me? And that made me, I don't want to say it made me stop because that sounds like it was easy. It made me turn off the computer for a day and then one more day. And then I went away for a week and then it had been 10 days. And then every day that I didn't do it, you know, I mean, that's what they mean by minute by minute. And then I realized that I was breathing again and that I was starting to be the person that I remembered.
Particularly hard for you to turn off the computer. You're a journalist.
I know.
But also your mom. I'm just thinking that you write at one point, I think the words were something like, that gambling had been the currency with which your family spoke to each other and shared love. And here, I mean, she had given you this in part.
And she didn't know. She didn't know what it was. I never told her. And funny enough, I waited till she died until I pitched this book. And now I could shoot myself because she would have been having so much fun following this with me. You know what I mean? She loved this. And it was the currency of our life. When I started playing poker again in my mid-40s, she was starting to go blind. But she would call me every night and tell me stories. And she really taught me how to play poker. She would tell me stories about how she played when she was a kid. And then I started picking her up and taking her to Atlantic City with me. And she was terrific, even half blind. You know, and so I just, that is my one regret, is that she's not here to hear this. And that I didn't tell her. I wish she had known.
What the thing was that
yeah.
was pulling you away from
yeah,
her.
Because even when I stopped and I would go down there and she'd, you know, she'd just sort of stroke my hand and say, you want to tell me, Cookie? I'd say no, because I thought it would break her heart. But I now know that it was my heart I was worried about.
Yeah. You talk about how, you know, one of the painful things is that your husband, you loved so much, you didn't tell him anything. Is it true? We were reading the New York Times article, an interview that you gave, in which you said did you ever tell him how much money you lost?
No, but the day the Times article, he read it first in the Times because that was one of the things about the Times was that they wouldn't do the story unless I told, you know,
how much money
I lost. And even when he read the book, and he did ask me, and he was so freaked out by it. Who wouldn't be when you find out the person you love the most has been lying and cheating? It's, you know, it's heartbreaking.
And spending your mutual money.
Yeah. And, you know, he works very hard. He's an artist, and $100 to him is an enormous amount of money. To a gambler, it's not that much. And I've always had a different headset about money than he did. So when Joyce Wadler from the New York Times said, when did you tell Steve how much money you lost? I said, when is the piece coming out? And she said, you're kidding, right? And I said, no.
That's the first he read it?
Yeah.
How much was it?
Between 50 and 70, I'd say, $1,000.
What did he say?
Well, he's been incredible. I don't think he gets it. He doesn't really understand the addictive nature. But he's been with me for a long time, 30-something years. And he knows my family. He's seen my family at work, and they, you know, have been trying to get him, as Joyce Wadler said, involved in their cockamamie scheme since the day he met me. I don't think he was surprised by it. I think he was surprised that it happened in my mid-40s and not in my mid-20s when he met me. Here's something else I think I should say.
Please.
At the casinos, it's regulated. There's somebody watching. There's a camera above head. But online, you don't know if it's you alone in your office and four other guys alone in another office together saying, I have this, I have that.
Do you think that you were losing because you didn't have your tools at hand that you'd have in a room where you could look in someone's eyes or memorize cards? Or do you think that they're manipulating the
game?
Yeah,
well, I don't know. I mean, I think that both, I don't know. I mean, yeah. I don't know. And I think that that's something to think about. And it's people say to me, how could you play online? It seems so risky. And I know that. And I'm sort of risk averse, even though I don't sound it. You know what I mean? I'm very clever about what might hurt me. There was something about this that just slipped over the line.
Yeah.
I mean, then now there are not only there are millions of sites where you can gamble, because you can do anything online. You can play poker. You can play blackjack. You can play slots. You can do anything. But there are millions of sites that talk about who's cheating and if there are robots playing. And I have no idea if any of that is true. I haven't played in a long time. And I think it's gotten much more sophisticated since I played. And so,
in fact, it's probably not healthy for you to be pulled back into figuring out why you didn't
win. Actually, somebody called the other day and they said, well, if you go online, it was this addiction specialist. And I said, Arnie, I don't think I should be sitting here downloading poker sites. Do you? I mean, I said, that's like an alcoholic, you know, tasting out the new vodkas to see which one is going to be the best. I said, enough is enough.
Right. You've quit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I never even think of it. I'm so over it. Huh. You know, that's all I can say. I'm just, it's not, so not a part of my life.
That's Martha Frankel. Her book, Hats and Eyeglasses, A Family Love Affair with Gambling, is now out in paperback. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Monday on Here and Now.
The pounding wave reverberates the dirge of her illusion, and home, where passion lived and died, becomes a place where she can hide while all the town and harbor side vibrate with her seclusion.
Robert Pinsky, former poet laureate, reading from Edwin Arlington Robinson's Eros Tyrannos. We'll hear about a new anthology meant to be read out loud. That's Monday, Here and Now. This week, U.S. Marshals began seizing Bernard Madoff's property, including his almost 9,000-square-foot Palm Beach mansion and his 55-foot yacht named Bull. Court documents indicate that Madoff and his wife, who's not been charged in her husband's Ponzi scheme, had up to $826 million in assets as of last year. Also this week, a slew of new legal actions were filed against Madoff by individual investors, but also by a state and a town. Securities regulators from Massachusetts filed a complaint against Madoff and a so-called feeder fund, as did the town of Fairfield, Connecticut. Tom Lorisella has been reporting on the Madoff story for the Wall Street Journal. Tom, let's go to the town of Fairfield's lawsuit first. They're seeking $75 million from Madoff, his family, and the investment companies Tremont Partners, Maxim Capital Management, and the founding executives of the management company Fairfield Greenwich Group, because Fairfield, Connecticut's pension board allegedly lost $42 million in the Ponzi scheme. So is this the first town to sue Madoff?
We believe it is. There's been a lot of lawsuits, but what was sort of significant is that they're going after not just Madoff, but also against the funds that helped raise money for Bernie Madoff. And their lawsuit also includes Fairfield Greenwich, who they didn't even invest with, but essentially their accusation was that Fairfield helped Bernie pull off this fraud by pulling in all sorts of money and not doing enough research on him to know that he was a fraud, that in essence they were an accomplice.
Well, and this gets confusing because Fairfield Greenwich is the investment firm in Fairfield, Connecticut,
yes.
is the town. So the town is claiming the investment firm should have known better. And the claim is similar to the case that Massachusetts regulators brought against Madoff this week. Now, what does Massachusetts allege?
The basic claim is that Fairfield Greenwich,
the firm,
did not do the job that it said it was doing in terms of researching Bernie Madoff's operation. Fairfield Greenwich is a money management firm. They charged fees for essentially finding other money managers, and they collected literally hundreds of millions of dollars, apparently, off of clients whose money went to Bernie Madoff.
Well, but doesn't the Massachusetts complaint also show that on behalf of those investors, Fairfield Greenwich, the firm, met with Madoff last October and tried to get information out of him, and he either avoided their questions or lied?
Well, it's an interesting question as to how hard they were really pressing Bernie Madoff. The allegations from Massachusetts are that this firm had such a close relationship with Bernie that they made so much money off of Bernie, as I said, I mean, literally hundreds of millions of dollars, that they really didn't push him, that there were very glaring signs that something was amiss. And they just ignored these warning signs because they were just making so much money.
Well, in the Massachusetts complaint, you say warning signs. There was one eyebrow-raising transcript of a taped 2005 phone call between Madoff and Fairfield Greenwich managers. Again, this is the firm. Madoff starts the call with, obviously, this conversation never took place. That's
right.
A little red flag there. And then coaches them on how to deflect a Security and Exchange Commission investigators.
I mean, what Massachusetts is basically saying is, look, here's evidence of how shady Bernard Madoff was. Here's this guy who you're entrusting your client's money to, and he's sitting here trying to coach you on how to get the SEC to basically get off his back. You know, there's no allegations in that that they knew exactly that Bernie was a fraud, but what they're saying is, hey, you know, this is the kind of guy he was. You should have known that something was at least not on the up and up. You should not have been putting your clients' money into this, and therefore you're liable.
Right. Well, Tom Lorisella, what is the thinking about what's going to happen? Will states and towns maybe have a leg up, or are they going to have to get in line behind hospitals, museums, nonprofits, and individuals who are all looking for money?
The interesting dynamic here is that there's a court-appointed trustee who is responsible for overseeing the bankruptcy of the whole Madoff operation. And it's likely that this trustee is going to be, you know, first in line when it comes to trying to retrieve money from not just the Madoffs, but potentially even companies like Fairfield Greenwich. You know, maybe even Massachusetts might have to get in line behind the trustee, but almost certainly, you know, private lawsuits, they'll have to sort of wait their turn. Either way, there's going to be a big battle amongst different investors to make sure that they get their money back.
Tom Lorisella, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Of course, we'll continue to follow that story. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Finally, the Final Four, the best in men's college basketball, play tomorrow in Detroit. The women meet Sunday in St. Louis as March moves into April Madness. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us. Bill, Saturday in the men's, Connecticut faces off against Michigan State in Michigan. This is a state that's had bad news. 30 years ago, we were thinking, you know, magic brought magic to the game. We are fans of Connecticut, but boy, Michigan could use some magic right now.
Absolutely true. Hard times in that state, and if their basketball team can make them feel better, then more power to them.
But what do you think? Can they?
Don't even ask me about who's going to win. If you could look at my brackets, Robin, you would know.
That's very personal.
You would know the meaning of the term embarrassed.
I don't want to see your brackets. Well, the other semifinal, Villanova and North Carolina. What is the thinking about who might go for the title?
Well, North Carolina, the only doubt about North Carolina when the tournament began was they might not be entirely healthy. But they seem to have done extremely well throughout the tournament, and they were my pick at the beginning. So I got to root for North Carolina so I don't look like a complete idiot this thing is over.
Your brackets aren't so bad.
They got one team in the Final Four.
Well, now, if Connecticut does prevail and take the whole thing, there's some speculation that the NCAA might take it back because they're investigating a recruiting scandal at Connecticut.
Right.
What's the thinking there?
Well, the ways of the NCAA are mysterious, sometimes even to themselves, so who knows what will happen. But yes, Connecticut head coach Jim Calhoun and his staff apparently broke some recruiting rules going after two different players. One of them never came to Connecticut. The other one is sitting out the year. So you never know what the NCAA is going to do, but there will be penalties if they're found guilty of this. It could be, you know, limiting scholarships. It could be financial penalties. Could be anything.
Right. Well, staying with Connecticut, but switching to the Women's Final Four, on Sunday in St. Louis, the Women Huskies take on Stanford. Connecticut undefeated 37-0. You know, is there a chance? You know, if anyone could beat them, could it be Stanford?
Yeah, that is the thinking. Our correspondent in California says, hey, Stanford beat them last time around in the tournament, and they did late in the tournament. And Gino Auriemma, the UConn coach, has said Stanford is better this year than they were last year when they beat us. However, so is UConn, a lot better than they were last year. Most teams haven't gotten within 20 points of Connecticut as this season is going on, and it doesn't matter whether they've been ranked or unranked. So I have to say that they will end up winning this tournament.
Well, Oklahoma faces Louisville in the other women's Final Four game, and the final is on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Just a quick look at baseball. Opening day in New York means new stadiums for both the Mets and the Yankees. The naming rights for the Mets went to Citibank. Yankee Stadium keeps its name and is still selling tickets. We saw a huge full-page ad in the New York Times today for season tickets. This is something that would never happen here in Boston.
Well, I was going to get down to a Yankee game and get a really good seat for one game, but I realized that I didn't have $2,000 in my pocket, so
stop.
I thought maybe not.
Yeah. It's expensive?
A really good seat, $2,000, one game.
Well, that might be why they're still trying to sell them.
Maybe why this market is still trying to function.
And one last thing, the longtime voice of the Yankees, announcer Bob Shepard, is ailing. He will not be there. But Derek Jeter made a special request of him. Let's listen.
Now batting for the Yankees, number two, Derek
Derek Jeter asked that Bob record his introduction, so he will, in effect, be at opening day.
Yes, Bob Shepard, 98 years old, will still be heard at opening day in the new stadium. It is a memorable voice. You know, we hear stories all the time about play-by-play guys on the radio with whom people associate their baseball experience from their youth. We less often hear that about PA announcers in the stadium, but Bob Shepard certainly has qualified for his longevity and his elegance.
He did his first game in 1951. The lineup included Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, and Joe DiMaggio. Pretty good. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Be sure to catch it. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's get some of your thoughts in. And I think we heard from every organic farmer in America after our segment with food historian James McWilliams, who said even some organic farmers are thinking that genetically modified foods might play a positive role in farming. He cited Dr. Pamela Ronald of UC Davis, a strong supporter of organic farming, who's worked on a genetically modified rice that resists pests.
She sees it as a way to turn a lot of Asian rice farmers over to organic agriculture. If you adopt this rice, it reduces the need for a lot of the chemical inputs.
Well, Cynthia Lair of Pomona, California writes, all these claims of golden rice are a smokescreen. Monsanto's biggest moneymaker has been Roundup, the herbicide, and Roundup-ready genetically modified seeds that can withstand 8 times the chemical dosing of Roundup. Monsanto's chemical assault is wreaking havoc. Linda Hesel asks, is McWilliams' writing or research funded by GMO-related industries? Well, Linda, we ask. The answer is an emphatic no. Kerry Haken of Kansas City writes, the environment is one thing, but what about the health aspects? We're allowing a food item to be sold and consumed that's been messed with at its core. And finally on this topic, Joy Barr of Birmingham, Alabama sent this email. You mentioned that farmers in India are committing suicide because their seeds are ruined by drought and age, and they're forced to buy GMO seeds. But I want to underscore, many GMO suppliers develop seeds which don't reproduce, and so this forces farmers to repeatedly go out and buy more GMO seeds. Well, thank you all. Okay, Fred McGee, listening on KPBS in San Diego, also wrote with a correction after I welcomed listeners in
Nevada.
But what did I say, Fielding?
You said Nevada.
See, now it's so I don't know why I did that because I know it's Nevada. It's not Nevada like I was some sort of Zsa Zsa Gabor. Nevada.
Well, a lot of people make that mistake, but the fact is the people in Nevada call it Nevada.
And it's very important to them. You told me the story of how now Majority Leader Harry Reid's first Senate race in 1986 was almost lost to him. His opponent was winning. But one reason his opponent didn't win may have had to do with an ad campaign that was produced out of state. And how did those TV ads pronounce the name of the state?
Nevada. And the candidate pulled the ad within just a couple of hours, but the damage was done. It made the candidate seem beholden to out-of-state interests even before it got to D.C.
Well, I hope that that story isn't foreshadowing for us. We promise we will say Nevada from here on out.
Well, you know, it also depends really upon where you are in the country because, for example, if you called it Nevada or Nevada in Missouri, you would be mispronouncing it because they pronounce it Nevada.
Okay, in advance, Nevada if it's in Missouri. Fielding, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Tina Sellers of Anchorage, Alaska also wrote, after our conversation with Michael Carey of the Anchorage Daily News about the effects 20 years on of the Exxon Valdez spill, Mike said that there was still some residue from the spill, but Tina felt that wasn't strong enough, and she offered a quote from Mike's paper. An estimated 21,000 gallons of crude linger, jars of oil-stained sand and rocks still being dug up in the spill area, can be examined at the Prince William Sound Science Center in Cordova. Tina goes on to say, people in the lower 48 should also understand that, yes, most tankers are now double-hulled and thus better protected against tears and spills, but Exxon continues to operate the only single-hull tanker in the harbor. Well, finally, Chris Allegretta really enjoyed producer Karen Pellin's piece on the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 Roadshow, where cast members of the old TV show do a running commentary about films while watching them with a live audience. But Chris writes, in the interest of equal time, you should also mention that other cast members, Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett, have been riffing on modern movies online. It's called Riff Tracks. Here's a taste of their review of Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith.
You know, when nobody's around, Yoda uses the Force to pick up the Cubs game.
Obi-Wan Kenobi has made contact. He said, ding dong, the witch is dead. Then C-3PO said, witch, old witch. And then he said, the wicked witch. And then R2 beeped something. It was really pretty cute. You could tell they had practiced it, sir.
Crazy kids.
Did they just make fun of Yoda? We'll link you to Riff Tracks at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also reach us by clicking on Contact Us. You can also call 617-358-0397. More ahead, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now, and our last segment today, part pop culture, part weather report, with Nico Case, who is like a warm front blowing through on a new album, Middle Cyclone.
You can't give up acting tough. It's all that I'm made of. Can't scrape together quite enough to ride the bus to the outskirts of the fact that I need love.
Middle Cyclone is Nico Case's sixth solo CD. It follows Fox Confessor Brings the Flood, also a force of nature, but critics are saying Middle Cyclone is more ambitious, more complex.
You said I was your blue.
Nico Case is taking a break from her work as vocalist with the power pop group The New Pornographers to support her new solo CD with a tour that's brought her to Atlanta, where she joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Nico Case, welcome.
No problem.
But you are sort of everywhere with this CD, people really throwing accolades at you. Let's hear more to explain why. The first track, This Tornado Loves You, a tornado love song?
Yeah, I had a dream where I was approached by a tornado and I was really terrified. But the tornado, I realized, wanted me to read it a book. And the exciting thing about the dream was is that the tornado had to figure out how to kind of calm down and ask me for what it wanted in a way that I would be receptive. So watching the tornado kind of shift its gears and figure out how to interact with a human being was very moving, I thought.
In your dream. And in your song, you give the tornado a backstory and a personality and a broken heart. Let's listen.
I've waited with a glacier's patience, smashed every transformer with every trailer till nothing was standing. 65 miles wide. Still you are nowhere, still you are nowhere, nowhere inside.
Tornadoes, cyclones, glaciers, wind, rain, nature, a theme. What is that about?
I don't know. I'm just a fan of nature and animals, and I'm always paying attention to how much people try to separate themselves from nature. It's kind of like there's been this cultural repression of instinct for centuries, and it's kind of interesting to see how that's shaped us.
Well, you mentioned animals as well. We know you've adopted 3 greyhound dogs, rescued them from a racetrack, animal rights, one of your causes. One of your new songs, People Got a Lot of Nerve, speaks directly to the mistreatment of animals by humans. Here's a verse written to handlers of a killer whale at an aquarium. Let's listen.
You know, they call them killer whales. You seem surprised when it pinned you down to the bottom of the tank where you can't turn around. It took half your leg and both your lungs. Now crazy hearts of sharks, I know you know it. I'm a man, 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 man eater. But still you're surprised, prize, prize when I eat you.
The song was just a reaction to the fact that there were so many animal maulings in the last couple years in zoos and whatnot. And people on the news act so shocked, like when the guy climbed in with the tiger and then the tiger killed him.
Yeah.
It's like, the tiger didn't even kill him right away. He was bugging him, and then the tiger killed him. It's like, the people on the news are like, oh my, it's terrible. It's just terrible. They're going to have to kill the tiger. What did the tiger do? The tiger's already crazy, living in a cage. And then some crazy frat guy gets in there. I would have killed him too. I would have. I'm not saying that that guy deserved it. That's totally awful. Or maulings are awful. They're I mean, I do find them slightly funny, so I have to.
You're conflicted kind of on this.
Well, I'm conflicted. But I just have a morbid sense of humor. I don't think it should really happen in real life, but in a Far Side kind of way, you know, a Gary Larson kind of way, I do find it kind of funny.
Well, as you say in another song on your CD, Never Turn Your Back on Mother Earth, this is the 70s group Sparks song that you cover. Mm-hmm. And fits right into, you know, the theme. But you also cover Harry Nilsson's Don't Forget Me. Can we just, let's just listen to a little of that.
Don't forget me. Don't forget me. Make it easy on me just for a little while. You know I think about you. Let me know you think about me too.
Those cascading pianos, six in all, you got for free on Craigslist and fixed up there. In the barn on the old dairy farm in Vermont, which you're renovating and moving into soon. And also joining your happy crowd in Vermont, frogs. We're big frog fans. You recorded frogs on your Vermont property and put them under the title, now you have to say this for me,
Marais la nuit,
meaning?
It means swamp at night or marsh at night. I can't remember which one. The frogs were so over the top, and they were feeling all matey. It was mating season.
We call them spring peepers here.
Spring peepers. Yeah. I love them. And so I went down with my little handheld recorder, and I got about 4 minutes of them that didn't have any of my corduroy pants going vroom, vroom, vroom. So, and I thought nobody would even notice the frogs, but it's really been probably the most asked question I've been asked on this record, which is kind of exciting.
Let's listen. Nico Case, I just want to ask you quickly about your CD cover. You're in a dress, you're barefoot, on the hood of an old Mercury Cougar. You got a sword in your hand, looking defiant, and also looking a little bit like that redhead from Desperate Housewives.
Is my forehead really that huge?
What do you mean? The desperate? No, I mean,
later Kelly's going to get out a projector and project a movie on my forehead.
You're very attractive. You know, I'm trying to get across an image.
Just kidding. I don't know why I said that.
What is the image you're trying to project?
Well, I really hate getting my picture taken. And so I thought, what if I tried to be a different person? And I thought, well, what if I was an 8-year-old boy and I was making a record? You know, what would be the most awesome, kick-ass thing I could do? And I thought, I would want a sword and a wicked muscle car. I mean, an 8-year-old boy in the 70s anyway, when I grew up. So that's what I went with.
Well, we were also thinking of your song, I'm an Animal, which we're going to go out on with the line, I do my best, but I'm made of mistakes. And there are things I'm still so afraid of, but my courage is roaring like the sound of the sun. Maybe something a little boy would say. Nico Case, her new CD is Middle Cyclone. For more, you can go to our website, herenow.org. Nico, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, sir.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.